Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Since the economic collapse of 2008 and subsequent recovery, economists, journalists, and politicians have both publicized and puzzled over how unequal the recovery has been. Despite Wall Street's celebration around the Dow climbing to 15,000, many middle-class Americans are being left behind, some through continued unemployment and others through stagnant wages. My guest today paints a picture of the economic struggles being faced by the 99%. Barbara Garson is the author of Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession, which provides glimpses of the resiliency of the middle class against unemployment, real estate collapse, and foreclosure. Beyond the personal stories, Garson also examines the long-term consequences of stagnant wages and what she says is Americans' increasing reliance on credit and bubbles, be it stock, technology, or real estate, to build wealth. Barbara Garson is the author of three other books, including All the Live Long Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work, The Electronic Sweatshop, How Computers Are Transforming the Office of the Future, and most recently, Money Makes the World Go Round, An Investor Tracks Her Cash Through the Global Economy. Her work has appeared in Harper's, New York Times, Newsweek, and The Nation, and her new book is published by Doubleday. Barbara Garson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This new book, Down the Up Escalator, looks at how we've always heard about how this has been a jobless recovery. And even as we speak today, the latest new employment numbers are again disappointing. And this sort of points up the fact that even though corporate profits are way up, the stock market is in the stratosphere, the ordinary person is still not recovered from the Great Recession.
No. And what I found writing about it, I started to talk to people who'd lost homes or jobs or money in the recession. Not only have they not recovered, but I learned that everybody I talked to had been kind of moving down over the last 40 years, they or their parents. That's why it hit them so hard.
And this has been one of the deep, dark secrets of our economy over the last 30 or 40 years, even though at times it seems like, as President Clinton said, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats. Really, it's been
for about 10 minutes during his administration, actually. I give him credit.
But it's been productivity that's been growing, not necessarily wages.
That's right. And, you know, that's really how we got into this, not just greedy bankers. Greedy bankers we have always with us, but what happened here was productivity grew by 99%, nearly doubled between 1971 and 2007. But wages stayed flat. They grew 4% over the whole 36 years, not 4% a year. So what happens is people don't have enough money to buy what they produce. So these banks get a very good idea. But money is accumulating in the bank because, you know, companies that have productivity is soaring and wages are the same. They make a lot of money. They put it in the bank. And the bank says, I have an idea. Instead of paying you to buy what you produce, I'll lend you the money. And so everybody that I met, just to have sort of a normal life, to send their kids through college, which I did debt-free, they have debts. To buy a house, they have absurd debts instead of an ordinary mortgage. Because the banks never stopped lending them. They had less and less money, and the banks kept lending them money. And that's a Ponzi scheme. I mean, if you don't have $10 this year, how are you going to have $15? And your wages don't go up. How are you going to have $15 to pay back next year with interest? So one way or another, you get into a crazy debt bubble, and this mortgage mania was just the last of it.
Now, one of the things you profile a number of stories that has been the conventional wisdom of politicians as they talk about. They won't ever talk that wages are flat, but they'll talk about how it involves an evolving skill set and that you have to be a lifelong learner and you have to move along with technology. And certainly any politician who talks about sort of long-term middle-class needs to stay afloat in a global economy will talk in these terms. Your very first story is a person you called Dwayne, and you've known Dwayne since the Vietnam War, right?
Right. He was a vet when I worked in a GI coffee house, or he was a GI then, yes.
And you sort of profile his story of how Dwayne was a person who followed that advice. He stayed up on the latest technology. He changed careers. He got new training. He was able to
and
find.
And it was natural for him too, because when he worked in the coffee house, he used to fix everything for us. Get the old mimeograph machine working, fix the record player, and he kept ahead of it. When he died, he was into laser computers, you know, lasers in manufacturing.
Tell us his story, because you said
it's almost no story. I didn't do it for my book about the recession. He died just before the recession hit, and then I began to realize. His children, who I spoke to, when he died, he had a house in Arizona, which he had fixed up beautifully. And the children went to sell the house and found out that if they did succeed in selling it at that time, they'd be $200,000 in debt. They'd still owe the bank $200,000. Mm. So on the advice of a lawyer, they sent the keys back to the bank and walked away. So their father left them nothing. After all those years of working, a $6,000 credit card debt, which was actually quite minimal. He did not live high. It was from his last move. And nothing worth anything. And this was a very hardworking person. He was a perfect example of the person who did everything he was supposed to do and couldn't possibly buy back the huge amount of productivity that he sort of produced. And that's why banks were full of money that they had to lend him for a house he couldn't possibly buy. And it's just a story of the economy and why banks had to lend to him and why they did continue to lend to him.
He had a lot of career education, not formal education.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing.
Courses, too, from time to time. I mean, he really kept ahead of all the manufacturing processes. In fact, he kind of was embarrassed in the mid-'80s when they were putting in machine tooling, because he did a lot of the automation that allowed them to automate the other machinists so they wouldn't be skilled workers like he was.
And he'd kept up the whole way, but yet, you know, that compact that American businesses had with the American workers wasn't honored.
Right, to give back the productivity. You'd share in the productivity, as we did starting from the end of World War II. In fact, throughout all of American history. But we really were a land of opportunity in that sense. But look at those four kids from the Pink Slip Club. Kids. Oh, my God, you see how old I am. They're in their 40s and 50s. They're living in Manhattan. They discover through their church that all of them are unemployed. So they form what a Pink Slip Club, they call it, thinking that, well, they love living in Manhattan. They're willing to make the sacrifice to do it. And they'll take the few weeks that they're unemployed to see free things in the city during the afternoons. And they do. They go to concerts. They go to rehearsals of things, things you can only do when you're out of work. And they are as modern and skilled as you can be. I mean, one of them does computer graphics for textbook layout. Another one is, you know,
accounts payable.
She works for an insurance company. One does accounts payable for a big media. And one is an editor on a trade journal. And they're the people who weren't supposed to be hit by the recession. And they're all unemployed, and I'm watching them. I took a long time to write my book, and I'm watching them every 6 months. I'm going back to another meeting of the Pink Slip Club, and it's getting sadder and sadder. Mm. And the most that anybody is able to find is a very unstable, by-the-hour temp job that literally half the pay by the hour. And that's unfortunately not just because of the recession, because I went to many companies that were, in the course of the recession, hiring new people, but hiring them in that temp, no benefits way, using the recession as an excuse, well, it was really a downturn, to lay off people with real benefits and real jobs, and take back people on the completely other basis of, we tell you every 2 weeks what your schedule is next week and you have no benefits, and like that.
There's been several reports in the recent weeks about how some companies have been abusing the temporary labor laws. And is this the next shift in the compact? Because I know you write about a family in Evanston, Indiana, a father who, you know, he believed he was a company man. And it took him a long time to realize that company compact, I'll stay with you, work hard for you all my career, and, you know, you keep me on as long as I'm productive and doing the job, and then you know, a pension, health care, and all that. And he was very late in discovering that that compact had changed.
He was also a very conservative man in any way. In other ways, his son brought me in to meet him. And he was a very religious man and a Republican, a very Republican. And it was so interesting to see the effects on the son of the fact that that the company didn't meet their compact to their father, that in his later years they were trying to move him out. They told him, you'll lose your pension if you don't get out, because they wanted to bring in somebody at lower pay, like the son's friends in school. I mean, it was like heartbreaking. And it's so short-sighted, too, because as I mentioned, your economy can't grow. We're what we call a consumer economy, meaning not that we're terrible consumers, but that we sell about 70% of what we make. We sell, and services we sell to each other. So if we decide that there's a contest to see who can pay people the least, we lose out.
So getting back to that idea, getting back to the idea of the compact, do you think this is the next compact that companies are going to say,
hey,
look,
yeah,
benefits really are malleable. We can do this with temporary workers or
exactly,
people who will work for an hourly wage, jobs that used to be salaried with the full package, the benefits, the health insurance. Do you think this is perhaps the new compact?
So. Absolutely. And I think it's also going to be, you don't know how much you're going to make each week. You try to get a few jobs because you don't know how much the work is going to be, so that you can be plugged in at the minute that you're needed. And, boy, it's not a very bright future.
My guest today is Barbara Garson. She's an author and playwright, author of several books on economic matters. Her latest is Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. And she profiled a number of people, everything from the Pink Slip Club to working families to a home health nurse who was losing her house, various portraits of people who are trying to survive since the Great Recession began in 2008, the latter days of 2008. Getting back to the Pink Slip Club for a moment, because I don't want to give people the wrong impression. You mentioned the fact that when they were first laid off, they kind of said, well, we're going to, you know, they had, most of them had some savings. They had unemployment. They figured, this is something I can weather, and then I'll get a job. I don't want people to think that, oh, they just said, well, I'm not going to work for a while.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No.
These
it's
are
just they were putting in applications from the very beginning, but they figured they'd be unemployed for a few weeks, because all of them could remember the last time, maybe 20, 25 years ago, 15 years ago, when they needed a job, and they found them very quickly just by asking around.
Well, I think for most of those folks, it would have been the recession of 2000, right, when the dot-com bubble blew out. There were a lot of people lost their jobs, but
these didn't.
And they didn't.
That was.
And you said the mood changed drastically over these months. It was just...
Well, you know, you send in applications, and you think you're up for a job, or you say in your mind, well, I've applied for this, and I've applied for that, and I've applied for the other thing, and you do these applications online, and you never hear back. No one ever tells you you don't have it, so you don't even know where you stand. These people, new people in companies, they're busy trying to get a telephone extension from a company they think may be hired so they can reach somebody, so they can say, did you get my application? It becomes impossible. So they just start taking in a roommate. Well, okay. And then you go into your IRA savings, and then you take a little money from your parents, and then, you know, I don't know where it's going to end. I followed them for about 3 years, and it doesn't look good for any of them.
Are any
couple
of them
going into early retirement, you know, a different retirement than they expected? They're not poor. I mean, that is to say, I had to adjust my mind. My editor sent me out to write about the Depression, and you know, everybody's eating, and they even buy takeout coffee. They don't go to restaurants anymore, but nobody's carrying a thermos. It's a different kind of poverty. It's not poverty, but it's something very discouraging, and it's bad for the whole country if everybody goes, if a great portion of us go downhill like that.
I think that was one of the revelations I think you had in the book, and that as a reader I'm sensing, is that the fact that the unemployed, I think there's two classes. There's ones that this is catastrophic and it causes a complete destruction of the family unit, of housing, of everything.
Oh,
and then and there's people like the Pink Slip Club who had some savings, had a 401k build up or some retirement savings build up. They're living off that. They're living between that and the unemployment. They're barely making ends meet. But if something catastrophic happens, they're out on the street. And they really haven't changed their lifestyle much. I mean, they've changed it somewhat, but compared to what you would think.
Well, they've changed it enough so that the other people know, can feel that these people are not going to restaurants anymore, or,
it's sort of the New York lifestyle. But,
yes.
but yet they're committed to remaining in one of the most expensive cities to live in.
I know.
In the country.
Four that I picked on as the Pink Slip Club, that's really what their life was about. In fact, I gave them the names of the Seinfeld characters, Jerry and Elaine, and, you know, it's kind of a joke in a way. They were the nice versions of them. They were very helpful to each other, and they were in and out of each other's apartments. And at first, the sustenance from each other was very important, mattered, helped them, but it wasn't enough. And I can see them. I'm a playwright. I don't know if I'm a great economist, but as a playwright, I could almost pick up the things that you began to realize that they were the same people, but their abilities were weakening over that period. It was really sad to see. And at least the smart ones of them realized that any kind of job I can get, if I can be a delivery person in my nearby store for a few hours, then I'm at least out doing something, and I'll feel better. But then you're taking a job away from another delivery person, but you do it.
Yeah.
Now, others kept trying to fill in at their own level, and oh, my God, it was just terrible. Because it's not just that they lost their job. It's that the companies continued to demean those jobs so that they couldn't get that job back at that level anyway. It doesn't exist.
That job exists at a lower pay level, lower
right.
benefit level.
More insecurity always.
Yeah, interesting. And this at a time when corporate profits are high, apparently, you know, major businesses are rolling in cash. They don't know what to do with it because they say they're waiting for the economy to come back, but it's this chicken and egg thing. It goes back to Henry Ford saying, you know, I got to pay my workers a living wage so they can buy a Ford.
Exactly so. And they seem to have given up on this country. I mean, they say, well, it's not going to expand. We're finished here. We used to get our workers abroad. Maybe we'll find some customers abroad. That's what they seem to be saying.
My guest today is Barbara Garson, author and playwright. Her new book is Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Talking to a number of people, from a home health nurse that was going through the mortgage debacle and the issues with mortgage foreclosure, the scandals involved with that, to...
Oh, my God, I had to cry. I mean, you know, here was this woman who thought she understood the legal language. Now, she didn't, and you could almost make a joke of that. But you know, she remortgaged her house. She had actually owned her house outright when she worked for a regular corporation in her home city of Richmond and had a job as a jitney driver. And then that company disappeared. Then she started working as a home health aide, at which I think she was pretty good, but that's an unstable occupation. But she did work sometimes two jobs, two shifts a day. And she made the mistake of refinancing her house, taking money out of it to put down mortgages for each of her children to have a house. Mm. And she just didn't seem to understand, for instance, the changing rate mortgage. She seems to think you'd pay at a low rate, and if you paid for 2 years at your current rate, it would go down. Instead, of course, it went up to 17%, then her son got killed. And she kept trying every legal angle. I met her in court the day that I heard a judge. She asked, "Judge, when will this happen? When will they come for me?" And the judge said, "The house belongs to them." And when I met her that evening, she would say, I think they hold your stuff. I think the sheriff holds your stuff for 10 days. I mean, she didn't know what was going to happen to her property. She didn't know how she could do anything. And I meet her that evening, and she's still talking about getting a lawyer, doing this, doing that. It was heartbreaking. And at one point, I did start to, because she thanked me for interviewing her, like that was some kind of favor. And I said, I started crying. I said, my stories never do anybody any good. And she said, oh, I know what you mean. My patients all die. Well, which is true. When you're a homeless aide, then you're called in for, dying people.
Yeah. Wow.
What a time that, I underrepresented people like that because I could only handle so much of it. I mean, I just don't know whether there are perhaps more people in that kind of position that I should have written about.
So what did you come up conclusion-wise about this? I've been reading a couple accounts about how this recovery seems jobless, and a lot of companies have learned they can limp along they can make money with a smaller workforce
and
also changing how they relate to their employees. And I'm hearing this time and time again. I'm struck by a book I read a few years ago by the futurist Joshua Rifkin, who said that the end of work was coming, that, computers, robots are going to be able to handle what manufacturing has to be done in this country.
That's fine with me. Remember, we used to talk about that, me and Dwayne that you brought up in the 60s. That's great if we share the benefit of it. If we're all working 2 hours and we're paid enough to buy back what we make in those 2 hours, I'm not saying all these that I want to sit around all day working for somebody else either. But I mean, you have to share it. Otherwise, we just have to fight for higher wages, which we did once. I mean, I don't know if we'll win again, but. Higher wages is the key to it, and it could be higher wages for shorter hours. It could be higher wages for safer work. It could be higher wages for more creative work if we want to have everything stamped out by robots and then we paint on them. I don't know. We just have to share it, that's all, if the productivity is going up so much.
Well, I'm struck by something a friend said, when globalization first began. He said, he sort of made his hands into a pendulum and said, if the United States is here and up high and the rest of the world is low, you can't raise the rest of the world without lowering the United States.
That was the theory of the free trade agreements. I mean, that's not the theory they presented to us, but that was something that those politicians knew, that wages would equalize, but it was actually brought down in those countries also. Factory workers and things like that. I don't know. I don't know how to answer what you just said. There's something to it, but not everything.
You think
it's not as if we are in direct competition with other countries for most of what we produce. On services and like that.
My guest today is Barbara Garson, the author and playwright of Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Well, what is your takeaway after talking with these folks? Is there policies we should be advocating, or is this, do you have that feeling of overwhelmingness that you described from that home health nurse, or that there's really not much ordinary people can do about the way things
are
going?
We certainly could increase wages. I mean, we could start out with the minimum wage, which is easy enough to increase, and we just have to do it. And nothing will happen bad to the economy, because every time they say, then they won't hire anybody at McDonald's if you increase that. Nonsense. We could start out by wages. The Financial Times, which is the paper I subscribe to, oddly enough, and it's good paper, they calculated that if the amount that went to wages, the percent of our productivity that went to wages now was the same as its average since World War II, that each worker would be getting $5,000 more in the United States. So I just say take that $5,000 back. But that's not easy. That's a fight that involves unions and involves politicians who can get a lot more out of the people who pay the wages and the people who earn the wages. I think wage increases, even if it includes shorter hours, would be the most practical, immediate answer, and it wouldn't set us back.
You know, one of the issues, I think,
but people have to feel better about themselves to do that. That's what bothered me most, that so many of the people I talk to, even in the middle of a recession, they read stories about the recession, you feel it so personally. Oh, if I had made a different choice than staying with this company, like the man in Indiana. Oh, if I had stayed with the company I left. Oh, if only. And you put it on yourself that I'm just not one of those people who buy my houses when it's low and sell when it's up, but I'm the person who does the opposite. Even though millions of people around you are doing the same and the whole system is rigged, you personally feel so bad about yourself, and that's when it's hard to make the change.
One of the things I see is the fact that with, you know, the service industry has gotten so big and it's tamping down a lot on these wages and on benefits and on use of temporary workers. You see a lot of people saying, I'm not going to go work for somebody else. I'm going to create my own business, an entrepreneurial sort of thing. And I'm wondering if that's maybe the next phase.
Well, I've always been that my whole life, a freelance writer. A lot of people are sort of called entrepreneurs. I mean, after all, that home health aide is an entrepreneur. She finds one job after another, and she promotes herself different places. So, I mean, that's one way of doing it. But people are doing that sort of thing. But you can't have everybody. We'll see how it goes. But I don't think that's... If we're all in that business, it won't work out too well. But if you don't have any job, you might as well call yourself an entrepreneur. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Well, the name of the book is Down the Up Escalator. Barbara Garson, thanks so very much for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Journalist Barbara Garson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. It's published by Doubleday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa and you can search our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Portico Dance Theater and Tulsa Camerata join forces to present A Midsummer Night's Dream by William Shakespeare at the Guthrie Green in downtown Tulsa May 31st and June 1st, both performances at 8 p.m. It's a family-friendly presentation of Shakespeare's classic comedy featuring contemporary and aerial dance, a live music ensemble, and custom animation. For more information on this presentation, which is free and open to the public, you can go online to guthriegreen.com.